Welcome back to the Overmatch Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin, and today I'm interviewing Oisin Feeney, who is the host and writer for the Troubles podcast about the violence and bloodshed in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Britain. Those are your words at the start of the podcast. Yeah, Oisin, welcome to the podcast, brother. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Your voice sounds very familiar. Somebody recommended your podcast to me because I did a post about Northern Ireland, and I have recommended it a bunch of times, and people have reached out and gone, oh my God, it's freaking great. When I posted this morning on Instagram, said I was going to be interviewing you, people were like, they've gotten so much from it because it's not biased one way or the other. It's just the facts. It's bite-sized portions. And this sounds terrible, but it's dumbed down to make it understandable because it's such a complex conflict that went on for decades and cost thousands and thousands of lives. And look, I grew up there. And I find it hard to freaking understand sometimes, right? Because I think there's just so many different kind of factors involved. That's so many different organizations and political organizations and paramilitary organizations. It was, it's very complex. So you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a lot of people just want to put it down to Catholic versus Protestant, but it's so much more than just two sides. Mm. It's multiple organizations, multiple goals, so much fracturing and infighting and everything. And yeah, so my constant strive is to be impartial and unbiased, but that can be very difficult to do. So, you know, not everybody thinks it's unbiased, but that's what I strive to do every single time I write. Yeah. I get some feedback all the time. Of course, look, if a podcast gets big, you will always get feedback. So mm-hmm. I got accused of bias on both sides. So I think that's a good sign.
That's a good thing. Yeah.
They're both coming at you. I think it's, you know.
Where you sit is where you stand, right? And people get so entrenched in that the fact that, you know, there's a quote from Abraham Lincoln about the Civil War, and I'm probably going to butcher this, but it's a great quote. He said that in great conflict, both sides claim to be acting with the will of God. He said, both sides may be, but one side must be wrong, right? If both sides say that they're working with the will of God, they can't both be right. Basically is what he was saying. And they're probably both wrong. And there was horrific violence from all sides in that conflict, right? Yeah, but I think your timing is great because I think more information is coming out now than it would have been tough to source some of this stuff, you know, even a decade ago. So let's get some context right here. Where did you grow up?
So, yeah, I grew up in County Meath. So, like I said, right beside, close to Dublin, for anyone who's not from the area. And then I did media in college. And then I went off to Chicago for a year. Then I came back and I worked for a bank. I hated that so much. I fled to South Korea for 2 years. and that's how I ended up. I kind of ended up in tourism, I guess, over there. But it was really cool. I was very close to the North Korean border. So we could explore all of the dugouts and everything. The town I lived in was set up for an invasion, basically. Afraid of one, but it was very cool to just explore pillboxes and all that sort of stuff. So then I came home, I found a job with the Daily Star, and I became like kind of like a clickbait journalist, which I hated, and I was just really bad at it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I left that, then I became a hiking guide. So I worked in the north of Italy for a while and over in Iceland. And all around, that was around the time I said to myself, okay, I've been listening to podcasts for 10 years now. What would be a good topic? What would be something interesting to put out to the world? And, you know, I'd had a couple of stints in Northern Ireland just visiting friends. And, you know, like one friend, we were just walking around and I was like, oh, geez, what's that like massive metal cage? And she's like, oh, that's a police station. Mm. And I was like, they still look like that? She's like, oh, yeah, there's petrol bombs attacks every couple of weeks.
I was like, I thought they took down all those big fortified locations, no?
They took down the major ones, but most police stations in rural towns and stuff are still very, not heavily fortified, but there's big, massive walls and fences.
Right.
And then just the way she talked to me and just the way some other people talked to me, and I was like, you know, we went up to visit a friend in Monaghan, and we were going to go on the booze, we're going to buy a load of beer. And so we're going to cross over the border and get beers and bring them over because they're cheaper, 10-minute drive. And his mom was like, oh, now, guys, be very careful with that car. And I was like, what? I was like, this thing is not a, but it's something that's built into the, I think, the psyche of a lot of people, even though there's not much of a fear of violence. Like, so this person initially that I went to, I was working with her for 3 days. We were working for the Northern Irish Tourist Board. And she was staying with, I'd pick her up and we were going to stay together for 3 days in different places and take pictures and all this stuff. And her mother was like, you're going away with Oisin Feeney. And her mother was terrified because someone so Irish was going to be spending time with her daughter. The mother had this real fear because she was obviously of the Protestant background or, you know, unionist. So it was just a lot of this sort of stuff kind of came at me, and I was like, there's obviously a lot going on. And I, as an Irish person in my early 30s, I don't know it and I don't understand it. There's no way anyone else in the world, if an Irish person can't understand this period, how the heck can anyone from the US get into this? And then I started looking up sources and started looking up things online. There is an abundance of documentaries all over the place from years ago. There's thousands of books written, but there was no real concise core collection of everything. And I kind of felt that, you know, I used to love the Irish History Podcast. It's probably the one of the oldest podcasts going, but it's about 400 episodes. And sometimes to start, you need to start at the beginning, and it's super daunting. So I said, I don't want that. I don't want to make a podcast that you have to listen to episode one. So I was like, what if I made every episode in no order whatsoever, all over the place, just pick one bombing, one attack, one person, and I made an open closed story. And I've made up this term. I'm sure it's a real term, but it's like kind of like a jigsaw education. So by the time you get through whatever 50, 60 episodes I have now, each one adds a different piece in a different direction. But, you know, now the episodes I'm putting out this season, now my listeners have kind of built up this background knowledge, so things all start to make a little bit more sense as they go. So I launched it as a true crime podcast because I just thought that the genre was actually a bit more desirable to go into. So 3 years ago, history podcasts were not as popular as true crime. It is definitely a history podcast, albeit a recent history one. But so
think it's
yeah, that's kind of
both.
where I went.
I think it's
yeah that's kind of
both.
where I went with it. Yeah, 100%.
I think you nailed it, having each episode kind of stand alone. You don't have to go into it with all this knowledge. I remember learning Irish history in school in Ireland, and I'm like, okay, let's go back 1200 years. You know what I mean? And
Yeah, pretty
it's
scary.
so daunting. It really is, and it's so difficult to learn. And you're right. Look, I grew up right just south of the border, and I would not say that I grew up in the Troubles. I was on the periphery of the Troubles. I saw it with enough distance that it didn't really affect me in the same way Catholics from Northern Ireland or Protestants from Northern Ireland lived with it every single day. But I think as I get older, I get more fascinated by history and how
Yeah,
things
same.
evolve. What's your source of information for some of these things? Like when you want to do something about the Lochall ambush, right? Where do you start?
Well, it's going to sound pretty shitty, but I'd start at the likes of Wikipedia. I check it out on Wikipedia, and then I go straight down to the sources down the bottom, and I go through what do we have? What are the, because the Wikipedia is a very good concise telling of what happened. So the sources at the bottom, in some cases they'd be reports, in some cases they'd be inquests, in some cases they'd be inquiries, in some cases they'd link to books. I don't think they don't really often link to like YouTube documentaries, but then YouTube would be my next port of call. And I've gone digging so much into like, I know there's a documentary the BBC released in the 1990s. How do I get that? Who can I get that of? Sometimes I might try and find the maker of the documentary and reach out to them. Yeah, and then kind of again, as I kind of progress with the podcast, because you know, a lot of people, somebody wants to interview me, or and they'd be like, oh, I want to hear your story of growing up in the Troubles. Northern Ireland for me as a kid was just where we went to get fireworks. It was something that was so out of my frame of reference. So as kind of the podcast progressed, I've now started to, and I guess as I got a bit more confidence, you know, when I released this anonymously. I just wasn't too sure where it would land. So I was just a bit uncertain. Then after episodes five or six, and the feedback was amazing, I put my name on it and kind of became more public with it. And then, you know, it just became quite important to me to not be speaking for other people all the time. I think that gets infuriating, especially to people in Northern Ireland. It's infuriating to have podcasters and everybody writing about them. So I don't know when I started this, but now I've really started reaching out directly to people. So, you know, and I think it's really important just to get them on and tell me their story. And in some cases, you know, so the like I got this ridiculous one. I got this lovely author guy reached out to me, recommended me do, what did he say? He's like, oh, there's this great author who wrote a book about torture in Northern Ireland, this American author. So I reached out to him. I was like, hi, do you want to talk about your book? And he was like, no, I've forgotten everything. I'd be a terrible person to interview. He was like, but maybe talk to this person. He'd be quite good for this. So say this person was Jim Auld. Jim Auld was one of the Hooded Men. And the Hooded Men were, I think it's 13 men who, when a couple of hundred people were rounded up in the 1971 as part of the internment policy of the British Army, this was their attempt to just smash the IRA by arresting everybody. But the problem is their intel was pretty bad, and the people they interned for up to 10 months, a lot of them weren't in the IRA. But of course, after being held without questioning or any liberties, they left, and a lot of them probably
They
signed
were.
up. Yeah. So Jim was one of 13 who the British Army decided to use advanced interrogation techniques. So Jim was hooded, and basically he was subjected to what I would probably call torture. The European courts have not called it torture. The British Army have not called it torture. So it's still an ongoing thing. These men are actually, the surviving men are still kind of trying to get it proven that it was torture. But it amounts to, standing in a position with a hood on your head against a wall for 7 days, no food, a tiny bit of water, loud no very loud, shrill noise nonstop. Very reminiscent of kind of Guantanamo. And like so much so that when people accused of what was happening in Guantanamo as being torture, the US government said, well, no. It was ruled that what happened in Northern Ireland is not torture. So therefore, what we are doing is also not torture. So anyway, that's a roundabout way of saying I reached out to Jim. He's in his 70s. We tried Zoom. It didn't work. I had no work the next day with my other job. So I said, Jim, will I just drive up to you? So I drove up with my microphone. I was welcomed very warmly into his house. We had a cup of tea with his wife.
In Northern Ireland,
And then,
he's in
out in
North, yeah.
Belfast, yeah. And then, and then he was like, okay, well, we do it. And we went into his living room, and then like I was this guy asking some man to tell me about the worst 7 days of his life. And it's a lot. It was a really, like Jim was an excellent speaker in the points that he made. It's what I launched this season four with. So now in a very roundabout way, sorry, I waffle a bit, that kind of got me to say I want to speak to people and have them tell their story that I can publish and put out there. So I just think I think it's the natural progression of this podcast, I guess.
It's funny you talk about enhanced interrogation. I've been waterboarded, I've been beaten, I've been sleep deprivation, not for 7 days, but it's part of our training here. It's part of the pipeline because you have to be able to resist and be smart about what you resist, right? There's no point in getting pieces chopped off for stupid information that mean nothing to anybody, right? So
Yeah, of
it's
course.
called SEER. It's survive, evade, resist, escape. It's a school that's part of the pipeline here. And it even after just a couple of days, it does mess with you mentally. Like to have the white noise playing, children crying, you know what I mean? Like the repeated screaming on loudspeaker.
After 3 days of being hooded, Jim, he hallucinated a lot, and then he kind of realized the only way out was to try and kill himself, try and knock himself over and smack his head off a rail. And that was after 3 days. So some of the men, there is kind of cases to say that some of the men died young as a result of what happened. None of the men died like during the interrogation, but a few of them did die quite young, younger than they probably should have, and their lives were never the same.
One of them came out with his hair completely white, right? That I
I'm
remember
not sure. I
seeing
haven't
that
seen that.
somewhere. I think that was in that book, Say Nothing. That's a book about the IRA. It's actually quite a good book. It goes through
I
the
recommend that
whole
to
history of
everybody.
it.
That's one of the better introductions to it, yeah.
I like that book. So when you so you've got your source information, right? And you lay it out. Do you write it all out first and kind of build a
Okay,
script?
so let's say I just started an episode yesterday and I'd love to get it written today. I'm about to go on a tour now for 8 days. I work as a guide. We'll get to that later. But I wouldn't mind having something to edit in the evenings. So I just started the Enniskillen bombing, or the Remembrance Day bombing, which happened in 1987. And that was the IRA planting a bomb, trying to get, I guess they wanted to get soldiers who were taking part in a Remembrance Day parade, but they ended up getting women and children, couples. They killed like three couples of elderly people. So how did I start yesterday's research? Basically, I did the trove. I went through all the sources I could find. I found three excellent documentaries. And then I kind of look for where these go because it's all each episode is world building. So this documentary is I'm so excited. Well, I hate the way I talk about this, but when you do get writing, it is it's exciting and it's a heck of a story. So this episode now is going to start with a boat off the coast of France that was boarded by the French officials and was just loaded with explosives
Was that the Marita
that I
Ann?
No, the Merida Anne was a
No.
different cup of tea. That was coming from
Okay.
the US. This one is, as far as I'm aware, I'm still in the researching phase. I'm pretty sure this one is coming from Libya. This is the Libyan, and they were all destined for Ireland, basically. So now, so using these three documentaries now, I'm going to weave together a story that'll involve the very linear, A to B. They planted the bomb, they blew up the bomb, people were killed, and then there was a quest to find out who did it. But it's also how we got to this context. It's 1987. The IRA are getting starved by the British Army. They're going to try and block their ability to buy weapons, and they're going to try and block their ability to import weapons. So it kind of leads out like that. So I'll do kind of, I don't want to call it a table of contents, but I'll do kind of the intro, the background, without getting repetitive, because every background could be the same if I'm not careful. So you have to make it a very specific background. And then, understanding what happened, why it happened, and with a very, very, my main focus, I guess, in a way, is try to be as victim focused as possible. I think that's the best way of remaining impartial. The people that I'm really sympathetic to are the innocent, well, innocent victims is a funny word, but are the victims who died. I think it's very important.
Yeah.
So.
I remember at the time when that bomb went off, there was a whole propaganda war between the IRA and the British, right? And that's every war is like that. And they call it information operations, and some are better at it than others, but both were very good at it. The IRA at the time said that the British came in and they flooded the place with frequencies and they detonated the bomb early. Do you remember, did you read anything about that?
Haven't got to
And
that yet. No, I'm like an
yeah.
hour into the research yet.
So,
Research while I write as well, because
yeah.
otherwise you lose too much stuff on the way.
Right. So the British obviously said the IRA detonated the bomb early to kill civilians, right? The IRA said that bomb detonated early because the British went in and they have the ability to flood the airwaves basically with radio control frequencies to detonate bombs.
Okay.
And that does exist. We used that in Afghanistan, and Iraq. We would go in and we would, like, on especially on the smaller roads in Afghanistan, you would fly a plane along that road and blast frequencies out to
Oh, so
detonate.
you're not trying to, so say, would the British
You,
Army's defense be, now again, I haven't got there yet, but would their defense be, we are blocking the ability for you to trigger the bomb, and the IRA be saying, no, you detonated it, is
Yeah,
what you're saying?
so you can do both, but the
Okay.
IRA at the time, if I'm not mistaken, I'm working off memory here, the IRA at the time said that the British deliberately detonated, they deliberately blast the frequency out there to detonate the bomb if there was any in place, which
Okay.
who knows what's true. I think there's two sides to every story, and then there's the middle that's probably the
Of
truth,
course,
right?
yeah.
But I just thought it was an interesting thing. That technology exists, and it did exist back then. So that whole information thing was a cat and mouse game the whole way through the
Well,
Troubles.
I'd imagine that's something the British Army would absolutely never admit to.
Yes,
Because
yeah.
again, that'd be, again, a lot of the troubles, a lot, I hate to say it, but a lot of the troubles was PR. It was good PR, bad PR. And the IRA were, though they had, though in a way the IRA and the cause of nationalism had the sympathy of the world, they also did a lot of things that made them hated, Like one of the interesting ones I always thought was, oh, it was the Ulster Workers' Council strike. I think it was 74, 75. But basically, yeah, I think it was post Sunningdale. It was the first agreement that was trying to get peace in Northern Ireland and wasn't liked by unionists whatsoever. So much so that I think it was the UBF or the UDA, one of the loyalist groups, decided to detonate a bomb in Dublin and Monaghan, which caused a lot. I think they killed about 30 people. It was a quite significant bombing. But weirdly enough, like say, if an IRA bomb went off in Northern Ireland, everyone would kind of be angry at the IRA. But when the loyalist bomb went off in Dublin, the general consensus was people weren't angry at the loyalists, they were angry at the IRA. You brought this bombing campaign to our doorsteps. So it was just kind of a different kind of perspective than you'd expect, if you know what I mean. But yeah, look, the IRA were very, very good at PR, but at the same time, their bombs killed. The IRA provision, sorry, what's the way to phrase it? Sorry, Republicans, there we go. Republicans killed more people in the Troubles than anybody else, significantly more than the British Army and significantly more than loyalists as well. So they'd be the number one massive scale of innocent death.
Have you done one about collusion yet?
Collusion is like a chapter in every episode at this stage.
It really is. Yeah, you haven't
So
done one
yeah, really.
specifically for. I didn't think so. When looking at, let's do this for people who are looking, going, man, I wish I knew more about this. Can you give me like a short overview of basically the British invaded Ireland and took all the
Yeah.
land and rented it back to the people, right? And then,
Yeah. I just did an hour ago, so it's still fresh in my
just do
head.
it. Yeah, just do
No,
it in a nutshell.
yeah, well, basically, you could kind of say around the 1400s, but let's push it around the 1600s, where the as part of the now again, I'll make some mistakes here, guys, because it's not fresh in the head, but as part of the English occupation of Ireland or coming into Ireland, there was a number of plantations all around the country. The whole island of Ireland, there was plantations that'll bring our people in and push the native Irish out and away. In a lot of cases, these plantations were focused on the most, I guess, fertile land in a way. So, around Ireland, many of these plantations were unsuccessful, and the people were moved off, or they're not supported by the local Irish who were angry to have this happen to them. But in Northern Ireland, it was very successful. It was a lot of Scottish settlers that came over and planted there as part of the Cromwellian plantation. And the native Irish were given two options. They could go to Hell or they could go to Connacht, which is the west coast of Ireland, Connemara, where the land is very difficult to till. And, to you know, that's why there's so many stone walls on the west coast of Ireland.
And that's why they still speak Gaelic there, because the Brits didn't bother with it.
They weren't too pushed. So then, like, okay, you're kind of looking at, but there was a lot of native Irish who remained in Northern Ireland. So then you have, if you look at this sort of massive plantation in the 1600s, and then you kind of just literally, we're going to go quickly, fast forward on 300-400 years. It's like the 1900s. Suddenly you have, I think it was about 70%, 30% population overall. It's a bit messy and patchy, but 70% Protestants, maybe 40%, like 60-40 we'll say, and the rest were Catholics. But Catholics in Northern Ireland suddenly found themselves separated from the Republic of Ireland. That kind of happened around the War of Independence, I think, in the 20s. So the six counties of Northern Ireland are considered, you know, one of the countries that encompasses the United Kingdom alongside Wales, England and Scotland. But then again, you know, this is a government that's run by the United Kingdom. So any of the, we could say Catholic, we could say nationalist, we could say native Irish. There's a load of different words. Usually people say Catholic or Protestant. But so any of the Catholics in Northern Ireland suddenly found themselves under a government that didn't support them. So bringing that to the 1960s, if you're a Catholic in Northern Ireland, you couldn't, you could only vote if you owned a home. Very few Catholics did, because look, wealth only just, you know, this wealth disparity that was started in the 1600s only just got worse and got more significant, deeper. So Catholic people in Northern Ireland at the start of the 60s were essentially a second class citizen. They couldn't really vote. And any communities where there was a majority Catholic, there was, via the process of gerrymandering, if there was 90% Catholic, that place would be split up so much so that any of the representation in government would be all unionist. So they kind of say Northern Ireland was a unionist country for unionist people during this time. You know, Catholics, I think around the start of the 60s was when free education came in. So that means the Catholic population got to get free education. But like social housing, you know, if there was a woman with, if it was a Catholic woman with like five kids and her husband had died versus like a young unionist woman in her 20s, she would get the social housing with no kids. Mm-hmm. So it was just, it just went on and on and on until the Catholic people realized this is, you know, this is ridiculous. Like, though apparently this is one thing I find interesting. The one thing that was slightly easier to do was open a pub. And that's one of the reasons why there's a lot more pubs, a lot more Irish pubs all around the place. I have to look a bit more into that, but it's one thing that makes sense to me. Yeah. I just don't understand exactly why. Then we kind of get to Martin Luther King. And Martin Luther King in the US and the civil rights movement inspired the Catholic population in Northern Ireland. They said, well, you know, we are in exactly the situation that the black population feels, you know, is in the States. We're a second class citizen, a two tier government. We're not getting the same respect. So the Catholic population started peacefully protesting and singing, "We Will Overcome." Like it was based very similarly on the Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So here's where things get a bit messy then, because so then the unionist population, at first, the RUC, the police force, I guess the way to put it is that these peaceful protests were met with violence. Now, in some cases, the violence was metered out by, I think, the B specials. I might be wrong here. But they'd be kind of like, not police, but they'd be unionist people saying, let's attack these guys. And the RUC didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And then in some cases, the RUC themselves started violently attacking these protesters. So it was around this time that the IRA, that had been fairly dormant, they hadn't done too much. In the 50s, they had a brief border campaign, but not too much. That's where the population in Northern Ireland, the Catholic population, said, where are the IRA? We need you here to support us. But the IRA were like a little bit more socialist leaning. They weren't that into violence-ish. But there was people in the IRA who said, no, we need to fight back. We need to get revenge. And that's where the IRA split. And the split group was like, oh, feck, what do we call ourselves? Look, we'll just put something on this and choose a name later. We'll name ourselves the Provisional IRA. Provisional means the name will change. The name never changed. So the Provisional IRA then were born. And with this sort of chaos, eventually the police force and everything, the Northern Irish government just kind of went, it lost control of the country. And that's when the British Army were deployed into Northern Ireland. And again, in this case, the British Army were welcomed by the Catholic people in Northern Ireland, saying, oh, thank you. You'll save us against this biased police force. Mm-hmm. But then the British Army started doing the same. The government of the UK sent in shock troops. It sent in the parachute regiment. It sent in troops designed for violence. And then the likes of Bloody Sunday happened, where the British Army like killed civilians. So every step of the way, I kind of feel like the British government made the wrong made the wrong choices in the case of de-escalation. They unfortunately managed to escalate. And then the paramilitary group started to rise, and then the attacks began. And then when 30 people were killed by one side, then 30 people had to be killed by the other side. And then it was a tit-for-tat cycle of violence that just raged for 30 years. Does that make sense?
It does. It does to me, right? But I like everybody says, oh, it's Catholics and Protestants. That's a byproduct of it. We'll talk about that in a little bit. It's funny how you say the British sent in soldiers that were trained for violence. All soldiers are trained for violence. They're trained for war. Yeah. They're trained. Your job in the military is the consumption of human life. Like, there's no easier way to say it. Like, you are trained.
Yeah.
And to be put into that situation, that counter-terrorist, counter-freedom fighter, whatever name you want to use, it's a very difficult job for a soldier. I know. I was in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? So I know firsthand. And when you, and I'm not standing up for the British Army, they made horrible decisions. But when you put soldiers in there, there's almost only one outcome. Because they're going to meet violence with violence. That's how they're trained. And they generally overreact. And, you know, I spoke to you for the first time the other day, and we were talking about something like this, but the more, like if I'd have grown up, you know, 10 miles north of where I'd grown up, I would have been in the IRA because I would have had British Army breaking on my door and taking away my father and my brothers, right? I didn't have to go through any of that. And that creates more fighters. And when I was in one of the times I was in Iraq, we breached a door with explosive charge to go in and grab this guy. I can't remember. He was Al-Qaeda. And when we came back, my warrant officer said, hey, we need to stop explosive breaching to gain entry into a house because we're blowing out all the windows in the neighborhood and we're creating more enemies than we're rolling up.
Just have to knock on the door.
So and I remember at the time going, I understand that theory and it's absolutely correct. But as the guy at the breach point, as the guy standing there, that charge buys me 10 seconds to get in there on the top of that guy before he has time to react and get to a weapon. Yeah. I'm trying to live through the next 10 minutes of my life. I don't have the luxury of worrying about the geopolitical strategy, right? And I think that happens a lot. The soldier on the ground is going to react. Now, in the case of Bloody Sunday in the 70s, the chain of command built up an atmosphere that made it okay. And Bloody Sunday was a horrible day for civilians, but it was a horrible day for the British Army because it built the IRA. People flooded to the IRA after Bloody Sunday, and it brought more recruits.
I still think, now again, I just don't know enough to really argue this point, but I still think deploying the likes of the parachute regiment that day was inappropriate. And I feel like the likes of the parachute regiment would be slightly different, I don't want to say the word ruthless, because again, I'm trying not to use
aggressive
loaded words.
Aggressive.
Yeah, the parachute regiment would be considered significantly more aggressive.
You're right.
It was a peaceful march. Mm-hmm. But in these times, peaceful marches had a tendency to have young guys throwing rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the young guys throwing rocks, I guess, was deemed the security threat. And then whether there was a shot fired, I think there might have been one shot fired somewhere, but at the same time it was deemed that the one shot that was fired either by a British soldier or by somebody firing a pot shot, that's what started it, that's what kind of the loss of gun control by the rest of the soldiers. And they just went.
No, I agree with Joshin. The parachute regiment would be a more aggressive unit and they would be willing to pull the trigger a little quicker, I think, than most of the units there. And I don't know what the answer is, because you go into that, you're almost in a no-win situation if you're an occupying force in a foreign country. Take Afghanistan, take Iraq, serve them both. It's almost like a no-win, because you can be nice and you can be supportive and you can go into villages and you can build wells and schools and hospitals and feed the people. And like we did in Afghanistan, as soon as you leave, the Taliban are coming in and they're executing the village elder for talking to the Americans. You can't. It just escalates. There's almost no way not to make it escalate.
One thing I found oddly poignant, I guess, is I don't mean to be too jumping over topics,
but
I was in Derry 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way into Derry, you pass by a housing estate with parachute regiment flags everywhere because they're just saying, you know, we support what happened. Because, again, you have to remember the unionist population in Northern Ireland now is threatened. They're feeling extremely threatened. And it's very important that they, you know, I don't know, but they feel very threatened now. And
is it true that the Good Friday Agreement left in a provision that if the majority of the people in Northern Ireland want to become part of the Republic, that is feasible? And is it also true that this year, is the first year ever that it looks like nationalists will outnumber unionists in Northern Ireland. Are those things true or no?
Yes. Strangely enough, one of the differences between like a nationalist or a Catholic family versus a unionist or a Protestant family, nationalist families were having 9-10 kids, simple as, over the past 30-40 years.
I grew up in a family of 14 kids.
Yeah, that was kind of my dad is one of like eight. It was kind of a norm.
That's a small family.
So it's undeniable that the demographics would shift. So yes, the Good Friday Agreement left a provision that if the time came, it would have to go for a vote. So just last year, the demographics shifted in favor of the nationalist population. And even politically in the sphere, I think Sinn Féin is the largest political party in Northern Ireland now. Mm-hmm. But that's missing one vital piece of knowledge. And that is, that's presuming every nationalist would vote to be back with the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah.
To be honest, there are many, many, I think only maybe 60% of nationalists would vote. I think it's about that, maybe less. Because, you know, being a part of the United Kingdom has its own, you know, it
benefits.
Healthcare, the mm-hmm. economic system, the government system. So my overall, I personally think it probably will go for a vote if Brexit ends up making their living situation shite. Mm. You know, if it becomes better to be part of the European Union, I think economics will drive everything. And all of this nationalism and stuff won't make a difference when you want money to feed your family, you want a good job, you want future prospects.
Yeah.
So that's, I think economics will drive everything. I'd say we will have a vote maybe in 30 years, 20 or 30 years. I don't think that is.
Let's talk about a couple of incidents where you, when you did the research, you were like, this was either brutal or super interesting, or, I mean, we can talk about it later on, the infiltration by the security forces of the IRA in intelligence was way more than anybody expected. But just even going back to the 70s or 80s, what were some of the incidents when you researched them were just like shocking? Like the Shankill Butchers or something, you know? Yeah.
Probably Captain Robert Nairac is one of the more interesting ones.
So
if you know Nairac.
Oh, I know about Nairac. So I remember growing up and hearing about Nairac when I was a kid. And the rumor was that he was buried in Carlingford, which is not that far from where I grew up. And it's between Dundalk and Newry, right? It's halfway. Yeah. That's where Jean McConville was dug up when she was executed. Yeah, she was found in Carlingford. So there was a lot of rumors about Nairac. He is still one of the disappeared, never been found.
Yeah, there was about maybe 12 or 14 of the disappeared who were people who were taken by the IRA and executed, and then their bodies were never found. But from Nairac, Nairac is kind of fussy because he was in this very kind of one of the British intelligence agencies called the FRU. And to be honest, there's so little information. It's very hard to know exactly what was going on there and what has been revealed or not. But Nairac was, it's kind of something I hear over and over again when I've talked to anyone who was like undercover or like a double agent or anyone who was an informer, any of that sort of stuff. You kind of expect them to be the quiet person at the back of the room listening.
Mm-hmm.
They're brazen. They get this sort of sense of kind of confidence. So what Nairac did was he went to, it might've been Cross McGlen, I can't remember the town.
It was, It was in. It was close to the border. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Do you want to say he went rogue? But basically, Nairac went undercover, and he went to this town presenting as an Irish guy, looking to, who knows what he was looking to do. But basically, this is a British soldier who was very charismatic and very kind of chatty and very, very good at. I think he had an Irish accent. Did he have an Irish accent? But either way, he was very good at kind of doing the accent anyway. And he goes into this Republican pub and he gets up on stage and he sings
The broad Republican black songs. Rimmer.
He sings a Republican song. Yeah. And could you imagine the people looking at him going, I don't think they'd clocked him yet, but the death, the thing he did that confirmed his death was after he was sitting, drinking, having fun. I don't know, was this sanctioned? I don't know what he was doing was sanctioned. It's still uncertain. But he asked, hey, is John Smith around? Whatever name.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. Everybody in this town knew that this person was a person non grata. They'd been booted out of the town months ago.
Mm.
And, you know, to ask about him, Paul was placed and a couple of guys showed up. And I don't know where the IRA or were they close to the IRA or whatever. But either way, a scuffle ensued and Nairac panicked and he went for his gun. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to even panic, but like when he got out of the bar and he realized they were coming for him, he ran to his car to get his gun. But like there was an army unit like 2 miles away. But I don't know. He didn't get to call. Maybe he didn't have a radio in the car. He just didn't get in time. He was taken, he was disappeared, and he was never heard from again. But the rumor was that he was put into an industrial like meat grinding machine, which most of the people call absolute bullshit. But I got a message like 3 weeks ago, and he was like, "Do you want to know what happened in Iraq?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, I'd like to." And it was like, I worked in I forget which prison it was, but one of the prisoners there, this was in the 80s, he was like, one of the prisoners there always had to sleep with the blue light on. And I asked him like, "Oh, why?" And he's like, "Oh, whenever this light is off, I have nightmares of Iraq going into that machine." And again, there's so much hearsay, there's so much stuff. But because what he did was so blatant, you know, the IRA would have wanted to make what's the word, make an example of him. And that's why, you know, that's why I guess in a way the disrespect of, you know, to it's very important to have a body to kind of really mourn. And I guess because of what he did and who he was, that'll probably never happen. And if what happened to him happened, there is no body as well. Then you know,
I
that's the
will
difference.
say, like, just from my point of view, from my military background, number one, I heard that rumor about Nairac when I was a kid. And I heard that that meat mincing machine was in Carlingford, right? I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard that way decades ago.
I'm interviewing the prison guard in a couple of weeks.
Are you really?
It'll be an anonymous interview. Yeah, it'll be interesting.
So when you think about a guy being on the cover like that, number one, very, very dangerous. Number two, usually there would be a quick reaction force on
100%,
standby,
yeah.
ready to go. We did not that type of thing, but we picked up sources in Iraq, in downtown, that were coming in to get
There's always
interviewed
a
for
cover
intelligence.
officer beside the undercover officer, yeah.
And you have, you're all dressed up and you're armed and all that, but you have a quick reaction force very close by because your life expectancy is very, very short if you get compromised. So for him to just to go out like that would be, I think he probably went rogue. I think he got
I
too
think so,
confident.
yeah.
I think every time he got away with something, he got a little bolder. And there was rumors of him being part of the Miami Showband massacre and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, I think they've been, yeah, that's a hard one to know, but I think they've been probably, I don't think that worked into the time frame of it. But yeah, that was a big one
Oh,
as well.
okay. Yeah. I mean, he either was insane or he had serious cojones, man, and he was a brave man. But there's a fine line between bravery and stupidity because when you get rolled up, now you're a liability, right? Now you have intelligence, and you people are gonna have to risk their life to go look for you. So for people to think that he was an SAS guy and he was out there doing this sanction, to me personally, with my military background, I highly doubt that. Generally, those high
So
level.
unless he could have been on something more secretive, maybe. But again, because he did kind of flaunt, he didn't have a great relationship, I think, with the RUC, or he was a little bit arrogant, I think, with them. So unless he could have been on something else, but it's very hard to tell. But to go up on stage and sing an IRA
I
song,
know.
whew, for me, that's going to
Insane.
be a movie at some stage. That's
Right.
going to be good. But there is, they have interviewed the person who was there for his interrogation. You know, I think he asked for a priest or he asked for a prayer. Like he was very, you know, his death was very, very gruesome and graphic, and there are accounts of it. There's just no accounts of where his body went. So,
Where another one? Let's talk about the Shankill Butchers. I guess an IRA killing. Let's talk about the Shankill Butchers and loyalist, basically paramilitary group, but gruesome murders.
yeah, they were kind of spearheaded by Lenny Murphy, who was the UVF basically. But this is where they decided that, say, if the IRA waged attack, if the IRA killed an officer, they were like, "Well, look, we might not be able to get the IRA. Let's just get a Catholic." So Lenny Murphy and his crew, I think there was up to 12 of them. There was a lot of them. They basically had one of them had an old one of those kind of black cab tours that you'd see in Belfast now, one of those old black cabs, and another worked at like a meat a butcher's, I think. So he had access to all of the like the deboning knives and all that sort of stuff. So for a period of like 8 years, what they would do is they'd cruise by kind of like, you know, Catholic areas. They'd look for young men coming out of a pub after a night of drinking, and they'd bungle him into a car, and he would be viciously and violently executed. And the accounts I read are absolutely horrific, like bottles shoved into his neck, and like really, really unfortunate, gruesome deaths. And so much so, how did it work? I think they did. You see, a lot of the times I think they were drunk, and in one case they thought they'd killed a guy, but they hadn't. And I think he went and pointed them out. You see, there are so many episodes in. I'm pretty sure he went in the car and pointed out who did it, and that's kind of where
Yeah, I
the
think the
guy like.
RUC drove him around, hooded up, and he to a loyalist area, and he pointed one of them out. And once you got one, and then you got the others. And I mean, they look on both sides, psychopaths on both sides. And these guys are serial killers, basically, who use the politics as a means. I think the UVF disowned them near the end because
That's actually the interesting thing, because I'm just double checking this now because I want to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, from what I remember anyway, we'll go with just remember. Go mm-hmm. listen to the podcast otherwise.
There you go. Yeah.
Lenny Murphy was either out or he was definitely out, mm-hmm. and he wanted to return to this campaign. But again, like I said earlier, PR was super important. The loyalists were like, look, we can't be, you know, these murdering butchers. Like, it's going to make us look, it's not a good look. Mm-hmm. And Lenny Murphy said, I don't give a shit. I'm returning to this violence.
Mm-hmm.
So it is believed that his whereabouts were passed to the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, is there actually proof on that? But so the IRA waited for him to come to, I think, one of his girlfriend's houses, and he was executed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was believed that he was actually given up by his own because he was too much of a liability to the mm-hmm. cause.
Yep.
You know, so it's, yeah, it's wild.
I think the cause is, yeah, it's always going to be more important than individuals, right?
One of the best examples of tit for tat, because I think with the Troubles, it's always tit for tat.
Mm.
If you want, I'll explain these three of them. You'll probably be familiar with all three, but it starts in Gibraltar with the Gibraltar shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that one?
I remember it.
Yeah.
I was not there, but I remember it. Yeah, I was in the Irish Army at the time. Those three incidents within a week or 10 days were insane.
10 days, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, go ahead. Ethically, it brings up everything. So that's why it's kind of, it's a good example, I guess, of the complication when you think of the Troubles. Because basically there was an active service unit, what they called it, the IRA. One was Mairead Murphy and then two guys.
Mairead Farrell. Mairead Farrell.
Oh, sorry, Mairead Farrell.
Yeah.
He's a local councillor nearby.
Okay.
So basically they travel to Gibraltar off the coast of Spain. It's like a British, I don't want to say colony or British.
Mm-hmm. Territory. Yeah.
Yeah. So their plan was they were going to collect a bomb car. They're going to plant it nearby where there was a... every day there's like, I don't know, it's a changing of the guard, but it's mm-hmm. like a parade. They do a military parade, I think it's every week actually. And their plan was they wanted to blow up and kill as many British soldiers as possible. Now, it's believed that these three were followed from leaving Ireland. The British intelligence was aware of this. So they were never not followed. I think when they went to get the bomb car was the only time. So then on the dry run that they were doing, I think they were basically parking a car where they wanted to park their bomb car. And they were going to swap out the cars, so they had to secure the parking place space. While the three of them were walking, they were confronted by the British Army, who killed all three of them. So here's where it gets very complicated. Those three are still honoured by the Republicans and Sinn Féin in Ireland as, you know, heroes who died and were murdered by the British Army as they were unarmed. The British Army's position of it is like, well, they were on their way to try and kill a lot of people. But then you'd say, well, yeah, but could you not arrest them? You know, they'd say, well, we didn't know if they had a detonator in their mm-hmm. pockets. We didn't know. But I think all three of them were shot in the back and killed.
Mm.
And it was just, it was a gruesome death. But it raises that ethical debate. Was it appropriate to shoot and kill them? A lot of people would say no. A lot of people would say yes. It depends on what side of the fence you're on.
It was a warning to the IRA. Do not do this outside Northern Ireland. Like, it was to me, the British Army were sending a message. I often, you know, the whole shoot to kill policy and all this, the IRA wanted to be treated like soldiers and political prisoners in a war, but they wanted to be treated by the rule of law. Like, why didn't you arrest them? You know, the defense was, oh, we thought they had a detonator and they'd blow up the thing. But I, honestly, personally, my opinion, they knew they weren't armed. They knew what was going on. They just wanted to send a message. I think Thatcher was the president.
I can't remember, yeah. That would probably be the time frame, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that would be her MO, right? You send a message. Yeah. But yeah, so those three got killed by the British. And there's a documentary on YouTube that goes and interviews Spanish citizens who saw what happened and recounts the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's actually
probably used as a source, yeah.
There's a lot of evidence that they were just executed, right? So those three get taken back to Ireland, and I think they came in on the boat into the southern part of Ireland, because I was in the army at the time, and got driven up across the border. And then at their funeral in Milltown Cemetery in Belfast, what happened?
So then what is described as a freelance loyalist, which sounds a bit odd, but mm-hmm. he's kind of like, again, I don't think anybody wants to claim him at this stage, but this man by the name of Michael Stone. So as the mourners, as the bodies were being, and this is actually on tape, you can watch this on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
but as the bodies were being lowered into the ground, Michael Stone walked into the graveyard and threw two grenades into the crowd, and then he opened fire on the crowd. killing three people. So at the funeral of three people, a loyalist walked in, threw grenades at them and shot them, and then ran. And the footage of him running across the graveyard, being chased by a crowd that would have killed him. They just got him. They got him on the side of a motorway. And if they got him into a car, he would never,
He'd be
he would
dead.
have been definitely disappeared. But I think the army or UC showed up and they saved him. They got him into a car. They brought him away. So that was just, this is like 5 days later, and suddenly there's this another massive attack. So the tension was absolutely ridiculous now, and the heat of the moment, and killing mourners at a funeral, like it was atrocious, absolutely atrocious. So then at their funeral, so the
So
next
just
funeral,
Oisin, real quick before you get into the next one, I remember at this time the IRA, not the IRA, the Republican movement had a lot of sympathy around the world, right? Three of their members were executed by British security forces. They attacked a cemetery of mourners, and it was all the propaganda value was massive. And then this
Yeah,
next one
insane.
happened, and it took all that away, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So at the funeral of the people who got shot by Michael
Yeah.
Stone, like only like three or 4 days later, right?
There was it was a funeral cortege. So it was going down one of the streets. It was lined with people on either side of the streets. And here's again where do we know the real story? Do we not know the real story? In the same way as in Iraq, something happened. There was three, I don't know, or two, sorry, is the word Lance Corporal? Basically, there was a new soldier who just arrived at a barracks. And one of the soldiers, it's believed, brought him into an unmarked car, and they went, I don't want to say cruising, but they went, maybe he went to show him the ropes. Maybe he went to
Familiarization.
show him. Yeah. So that's something that, they would have known this would have taken place. They would have known this funeral was happening. So by some instance, this man drove the car down and straight towards the funeral procession. Not speeding, but he just took a turn down, and suddenly he's driving forward and they're surrounded by a crowd. And they panic. They panic. The crowd is looking at them and doesn't know what's happening. Then somewhere along the way, he brandishes the gun. Both of the soldiers had a. They were again. They weren't dressed in soldier gear. They're in regular clothes. But then he brandished the gun. The crowd thought, "There's another attack. They're coming to kill us again. They're coming." Blah 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 blah. So the two men in the car were absolutely terrified. They were trying to speed off. The crowd pulled in. You can see this footage online. He shot in the air. The crowd pulled back for a second, and then they surged on him. And the two men were dragged out of the car, and then in full view of the media, the men, they were, I don't think they were quite ex I think they were executed in another vehicle. I don't think they were killed in, but they were basically in a very quick period of time, they were killed and dumped. And the media were then accosted by members of the IRA going, "Give us your tapes, give us your cameras, give us your tapes, give us everything." And then there's this famous photo of a priest, Ryan, I think, Reed, Alex Reed, I think his name is, delivering the last rites to this bloodied man who had already died, I think, at this stage. But so basically, I hate to, like a crowd just rushed upon the car and killed these two soldiers outright. And so, this is 10 days of absolute chaos. And some very, very controversial killings that there's very little way to justify, I think, all three of them, to be honest, in any way.
It was ridiculous. And I remember at the time, everybody was like, "What the hell is going on? This
Yeah,
has to stop."
chaos,
But of course, it didn't
chaos.
stop, right? Because it went on for another freaking 20 years after that, or whatever it did. Not 20 or 10 years after that, at least. I think that was in the 80s, right? 87, something like that.
Yeah, I'm saying my brain's saying 86, but I think
It might have been
yeah.
86. Yep. Horrific, horrific incidents. So let's talk about the Good Friday Agreement and how it kind of came about. And then it kind of went off the rails a couple of times before it took hold.
Don't
And
like.
it's still a little tentative, I think, right? Or hopefully it's
Yeah.
not. I'm kind of out of touch since I left Ireland, but
It's my
yeah.
most recent episode, so it's the one I probably have the most
I listened
clarity
to it.
on.
I
'Cause
listened to
yeah,
it,
so it's
yeah.
just after 5 episodes, you just kind of
Yeah.
forget a load of the
I
stuff. You
know,
have to brush
right?
yourself up.
Yeah, I did listen to your Good Friday one. Yeah, let's talk about that agreement.
Well, okay, yeah. Well, there was a couple of attempts at a kind of peace. So one of the first ones, like the Sunningdale Agreement, which was in the 70s, that was hated because it affirmed Northern Ireland as a part of the Republic of Ireland, I think. Again, you'll have to double check some of these on me or whatever, just give it a Google. Then there was the Anglo-Irish Agreement, which again failed. That just upset everybody. So
You know,
again,
I was in special ops in Ireland when that happened, And I did security for Margaret Thatcher when she came in to Dublin Airport. And it was right after some of those shiploads of arms came in. And it was believed that the IRA had surfaced air missiles to shoot down planes at that point. Now, that was never proven. And we spent a long time looking for it.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, you're coming in from England to Dublin Airport. There's like a 5 mile stretch of land before you actually land. And it was feared that the IRA would shoot down Thatcher's version of Air Force One, right, her plane. So her plane came in, landed, taxied, and just sat there for like 30 minutes. And then two Wessex helicopters came in and landed, yeah, and she got off one of the helicopters. The plane was a decoy.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, yeah. That's how serious they took it, but.
Had to be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, so like if you're coming then, you're coming up to the 90s, and basically the IRA, what's the word? Their war was a war of attrition, which essentially is like, we'll just keep going. We'll just keep going. We'll blow up as many barracks and police stations as we can in Northern Ireland, and then we'll take that ground and seize it so they can't grow it back. We'll just keep going and going. So the IRA, like people pro provisionals or whatever would say they could have gone forever. They could have kept going. But in reality, by this stage, the British intelligence was, but people have said parts of the IRA were like a sieve. There were so many informers, so much intelligence that it was becoming nearly impossible to operate without the operation being, you know, like towed on. Like, you know, we probably will talk about it now, but like, sure, the IRA's main executioner, who was the one who would seek out informers and he'd kill them, he was an informer for the British government.
Yeah, a big one.
It was so, yeah, he just died yesterday.
Scapatici, yeah.
Yeah, so there'll be some interesting things coming out of his death, but we can go back to that. But basically, you know, like you could kind of say, were the IRA winning? Were they not? The IRA's goal was an independent Ireland, and they believed that, look, if violence wasn't working, we'll go to the ballot box. And Sinn Féin had made some significant progression since the hunger strikes in the early 1980s. So, you know, eventually they needed to come to an arrangement. They needed to figure out a way to make peace, to bring an end to it. So that was where the Downing Street Declaration came in. That was like 92 or 93. And that was where they agreed that there would be peace talks, and that if the peace talks were to happen, then there would be a ceasefire between the different groups. So, yeah, that was kind of the start of it, but it was really, really messy because when it went on to the peace talks, this is when Bill Clinton sent over George Mitchell to be the chair of the peace talks. So George Mitchell was a very prominent US senator at the time. And the peace talks would take place between George Mitchell at the chair, then you'd have Tony Blair from England, you'd have Bertie Ahern from Ireland, and then you'd have, I think it was 10 political parties in Northern Ireland, that then eventually went down to 8. But for any of them to enter into these talks, they all had to agree to what was called the Mitchell Principles, which were like, essentially, there's a load of them, but essentially saying, we will have a ceasefire and then we will be allowed to take part in these talks. So that's essentially what happened. But the IRA were then speaking through Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin and the IRA were kind of, one was political, one was violent, but they were kind of all in the same bed together at this stage. And the proviso of Sinn Féin entering the talks was a complete ceasefire by the IRA, which they were okay with, and they did an initial ceasefire. But then the British government demanded that they put all of their weapons beyond use, that they put away all of their weapons. And the IRA didn't trust that these peace talks would lead to peace. And they were like, no, we'll only put half our weapons away, or we'll start doing the steps. And it took them about a decade to, I think. So that's where things got kind of messy. And that's where the IRA then, they had a ceasefire, I think, from 94 to 96 or 95 to 96. And then they woke it up by this massive Canary Wharf bombing, it's called, in London, which it killed, I think only one or two people were killed in a very, very significant bombing. So it was just a very good evacuation procedure. I think in Manchester then there was another bombing too. Yeah, I don't know how far I keep going with it, or I don't know how much, you know, but it then led to the peace talks that were just so difficult. And so it took 2 years before they could even agree on what the topics were. And in a lot of cases, like David Trimble, who's the head of the UUP, the Unionist, Ulster Unionist Party, he wouldn't even speak to members of Sinn Féin who were there. So you're sitting at a round table talking to people where half of these people refuse to speak to the other half. I spoke to Bertie Ahern 2 weeks ago, and he said that Ian Paisley didn't shake his hand for 8 years. Because Ian Paisley was with the DUP, was at the talks. But the DUP left the talks after the admission of Sinn Féin. Once Sinn Féin were back in, the DUP said no.
Yep.
No. So the DUP left. And then eventually, of course, the agreement was done. But the agreement kind of was the end of these centre-middle parties on either side of the fence. So SDLP, which were the Nationalist Party, and the UUP, the Ulster Unionist Party, they ended up getting losing. They had the dominance throughout most of the Troubles or most of that sort of era. And then it went out to the fringes. Then the DUP became the dominant Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, and Sinn Féin became the dominant Nationalist Party. So, of course, it put everything straight onto the fringes. And then the DUP and Sinn Féin have been essentially leading the country since 2008, but together. But the DUP are the ones who didn't want the Good Friday Agreement in the first place. They're the ones who refused to take part, who left the talks. So, how do you expect for these people to get along? And they haven't been getting along. They've collapsed. You see, again, one of the biggest problems in Northern Ireland is if the two sides disagree over some scandal or something that happened, they can collapse the government and nothing gets done. So in the, what's the word? I think in the 23 years that the Northern Irish government has been operating since the peace agreement, it's been collapsed for 8 years. 8 years of no
That's
progress.
insane. Yeah, and I assume things have gotten better for Catholics under this in Northern Ireland, or is that an assumption? They can be in the police now. They can. They, yeah.
Well, that was all part of the Good Friday Agreement. If they disbanded the RUC, they set up the PSNI, the new police service. They got rid of a lot of the barracks. Absolutely. The vast majority of people in Northern Ireland finally had peace. They finally could go to the shop and not be afraid of blowing up in a car bomb. But that's like with the original split to the provisional. That's where the provisional then split to the real IRA and then the new IRA. So, and then they're the ones who are determined to continue the campaign of violence. And that's what led to 4 months after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, the OMA bombing, which was a massive bomb detonated by the real or the new IRA. I always get them mixed up, which killed men, women, children, Catholics, Protestants, Spanish people. Like it was a disastrously violent bomb that I always kind of say, in the way the Bloody Sunday heralded in the Troubles, the disgust caused by the OMA bombing and how it killed so many people and unborn babies and everything, that just heralded it out. People were like, we don't want this ever again. We don't
Yeah.
want this.
And I think
So.
they probably had been given a little bit of hope with the Good Friday Agreement, right? And they were like hanging on to this little, and then this thing happened, and it was you remember how many people were killed? There was a lot, like
I think it was 31.
jeez. And then
I
there
think
was a
it's
very
done.
famous photograph of a man standing in front of the car before it detonated with a child in his arms. Like, just horrific. And people were like, okay,
They so
yeah.
29 people died. They
29
survived the
people.
bombing, but the photographer was killed.
Oh, that's right.
So, and again,
Insane.
it was down to I don't know what to phrase it. Basically, they wanted to plant a bomb at the courthouse.
Yeah.
They couldn't find parking, so they planted it maybe 300 meters down the street. I walked the street. It's about a 5 minute walk from one end to the other. So the police get a call saying there's a bomb at the courthouse, and they evacuate everyone from the courthouse, and everyone was evacuated into the bomb. So, and the IRA said, well, we phoned in a car bomb warning. Yeah, but you phoned in a car bomb warning for 300 meters away. So
It's insane.
it's shocking and awful. And
The other big sticking point of the Good Friday Agreement was the release of prisoners, right? So everybody got out, to include Michael Stone, who attacked that funeral, and people on both sides who did horrific
I
things.
think he's gone back in. I think so.
Has
He
he?
didn't stay out too long. I think
Yeah.
he might be back out now, but he approached Stormont with a knife and he tried to walk into the House of Parliament with a knife
Not
or
the most
something.
stable guy. Yeah. And
No,
again,
no.
horrific violence on both sides, and people, and I think a provision of them getting out was that they're on probation almost, and if they get back in
Yeah,
paramilitary
it's a
activity,
license of
and
release, it's called. It released over, oh, geez, I think it was maybe 400 people. Because, look, at the same time, to make peace, there's no point in making peace with the political parties. You have to make peace with the people who are willing to carry out the violence. And the vast majority of these people who killed people in the name of this conflict, they would argue they wouldn't have killed people in any other circumstance in life, There's a very harrowing interview, I think, during the peace process where Michael Stone sat down, I think it was with the wife of somebody that he killed, and Desmond Tutu, because he was part of the peace process. He was this famous archbishop from South Africa, I think. And like Michael Stone tried to, I think he tried to either hug her or shake her hand or whatever, and she has to just leave in disgust. She was so upset. It's a very unpleasant interview. But like, so the prisoner release really, really, really upset the unionist population in Northern Ireland, who in a way I think separated things a little bit. I don't think they were even happy to have their own people who killed in their name, in the name of unionism, they just saw like 400 murderers about to be released. I'm not too sure what the opinion of was on the other side, on the nationalist side. Like, it was necessary. The
It
vast
was.
majority of people who were released never killed again. I did come across a stat saying that 80% of them have not worked in that time. I don't know if that's, again, socioeconomics. I don't know if that's just, it's very difficult, but it was probably the most contentious issue for the whole Good Friday Agreement. The release of, like, even the Shankill butchers, people who killed maybe 13, 14 people were released and free. And
Insane.
that's a lot. That's a very heavy burden
It
to
really
now.
is. Where does Northern Ireland sit now, like economically, and is it still like a powder keg, or is it somewhat stable, or like where's this Brexit thing going to influence? In your opinion, what's in the future here?
The marginalized community now would be the DUP, and unionism in a way is becoming marginalized. There were people, Joe Biden arrived to Belfast today, and there were people protesting saying, "Go home, Provo Joe. Provo Joe, okay, Joe, you're in the provisionals." Because they believe that everyone is against them in a way. And at the same time, what's problematic for unionism in Northern Ireland is they see themselves as British and loyal to England. I'd really like to speak to someone in unionism. I think I need to work on my arguing with that, because I just need to speak to someone who can explain it to me better. But the United Kingdom doesn't particularly seem to make much of an effort to care for Northern Ireland at all as one of its countries and stuff. So a lot of people in England would be like, "Oh, they're just Irish." So it's good, but it's not great. There was a John Caldwell, who was a PSNI officer in OMA, who was violently shot about a month ago. Don't he I won't say anything, but basically he's put in a coma and he was riddled with bullets. Basically, I don't think it's looking good. It's been very quiet, the news, for the past month, so I have a feeling it might not be great for him. So like this is a month ago now. This attack is purported to be carried out by nationalists, these new real IRA guys. But they did, during their investigations, there were loyalists also arrested, which doesn't make any sense. I don't know why these two would be working together to try and execute an officer. So I don't know. The DUP are a very difficult party, because I guess in a way, because they're the leading unionist party right now. Some people call them dinosaurs. It's very hard if you're a moderate unionist in Northern Ireland. Even supporting the DUP is quite difficult. They're against like gay rights. They're a party that seems to be kind of a little bit back in the past a little bit. They had a leader of the party there recently who didn't believe in dinosaurs. He believed the Earth was created 4,000 years ago or something. And so it's I really want to speak to one of them, and I'd love to hear the DUP suggest what, instead of just saying no to everything. They said no. They suggest Brexit. They said no to the Northern Irish Protocol. I think they're still saying no to the Windsor Treaty, which was the adjustment on that. So, what can be done to kind of to make this community agree, I guess, is the way to say it, So
If you're against everything, then you're for nothing. Yeah, you gotta you know,
yeah.
you, in a negotiation, you don't get everything you want, right? You gotta bend a little bit. And there was a lot of bending done by all parties to get the Good Friday Agreement done and to get somewhat peace. I think, all the not all of it, but a lot of the support the IRA had in Northern in from America would have been hurt after 9/11. I think the American public looked at that stuff differently after 9/11,
Colombia.
but yeah, exactly. Are they did those guys ever get out? The guys that were in Colombia training the FARC?
Well, I'll explain it, but basically, where did they get arrested? But so look, you're in the IRA. The IRA excelled at a lot of their types of attacks, and one particular attack was called their mortar bomb technology, which you probably would have seen. I believe actually the IRA pioneered what you probably saw and fought against in Iraq, I'd imagine, because I think that technology was used over there as well.
I'm sorry, I've seen IRA vans when I was in the Irish Army that were set up for it and defused right before they got across the border, and it had the mortar tubes inside. It's not a conventional mortar, it's shooting gas canisters, and they fly through the air like this and make a horrific noise, but devastating when they hit. And they had them rigged up in the back, and I've seen this van, had them rigged up in the back in rows of six or four or whatever, and the one I saw was rigged with lights to show how it didn't, it fired them in a specific sequence to keep the van stabilized, and the roof was cut off and a tarp was put across it, so it was from the air it looked like it had a roof. And just pull the tarp off, set the timer and walk away. And when it fired all its mortars, it detonated and blew up all the evidence, you know.
Yeah.
And they really got good at it. And
yeah, so they needed money. FARC in Colombia had a lot of money. They had a lot of drug money. So somewhere along the way, over a period of, I think, 5 years, about 12 men left Northern Ireland. This is around 99-2000, around 2000, I think. And it's believed that they went over to Colombia to train FARC rebels in how to use these mortar technology to wage war. And FARC went on to their devastated civilians with this and some other stuff as well. So then they get caught. And like, I guess for the people of the US, I think it was just before 9/11. But then you're kind of saying like, okay, you know, we support the IRA's cause or whatever. But they're like, wait a sec, we don't like FARC. And these people are helping FARC. And that was one of the turning points. I think this was post 9/11 they were caught, actually. But it was all around the same time that just kind of made suddenly the word terrorist suddenly started to come out. That's a word I never used in the podcast. I just don't like using it. But suddenly that sort of kind of that thinking came about.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it lost a lot of support for kind of this Republican cause or whatever. Or it just changed perceptions, especially in the States.
I remember when you know, the Irish Army are in Lebanon and have been for a long time. They would have for a while, but I was in Lebanon twice when I was in the Irish Army. But I remember talking to an older guy in the Army, and he'd been in Lebanon in like 82 or 83 or something like that. And they were driving from South Lebanon up towards Beirut. I don't know where they were going, but they got stopped by a PLO checkpoint. And the PLO said, and I can't substantiate this, I'm retelling a story that was told to me, but he told me that the PLO stopped them on the checkpoint, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and they said, oh, you're Irish. Oh, we have Irish in our camp up the road. I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me, but...
You never know.
Okay, let's say... Let's talk about what you do, basically, when you're not doing the Troubles podcast. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Oh yeah, so I used to work as a hiking guide in Italy for this American company, and then
you've been to the Dolomites.
Yeah, I love the Dolomites. I try to go every year. Yeah, it's the most beautiful place in the world. I think it's just phenomenal. So yeah, so I came home. It was kind of one of those everything moments, like big breakup, big job was gone, COVID hit, I moved back in with my parents, and I was like, fuck me, like this is just pure reset.
You're going the wrong way, right? You're going the wrong direction.
Not what you wanted. Not what you wanted. So my dad had left his job in the bank. My dad's a petrol head. Like he's always had cars. He's always had to be in a car. All of his jobs revolved around him driving. He used to race cars in Mondello. He was a driving instructor. He was a commentator. It's just everything my dad's cars. So he decided to get into the chauffeur industry. So you kind of buy a nice black car, and then you kind of do the business chauffeuring, and then you occasionally get the odd kind of tour. So he was like, look, get your chauffeur license, get a big car. So I like have a 6-seater kind of Mercedes van. And then I started basically doing a lot of corporate work, but that doesn't suit me. I like to talk. Mm-hmm. I love to show my country off. So for the past 2 years now, I've been doing kind of like guided tours of Ireland, basically. So like I pick people up in the airport, I drive them all around Ireland, bring them to all these hotels. I'd be like a driver guide kind of for private tours of Ireland, is how we call it. So, I've been doing that now. I'm just about to go on a tour tomorrow. And yeah, I've got my summer is pretty booked now up until July. I have a bit of free time, but I'd imagine that the tours will keep coming in. So, and I really enjoy them. You know, you never know who you're going to get in the car. You never know what stories or what frame of reference they're coming at. And I hate to sound cheesy, but I'm just really passionate about Ireland.
I love
Connemara. I love the Dingle Peninsula. I love doing Northern Ireland, but the legalities are a bit weird. You can kind of only go up and come back. Yeah, there's ways. So yeah, so that's kind of what I've been doing now. And I think that it's a dilemma. It's either go full time podcasting or go full time tour guiding. I've been doing both now quite successfully for the past 2 years. So I guess you can do both.
Do you have a website?
Yeah, so our website is mgfchaufferservice.com. Mm-hmm.
We'll put it in the notes on YouTube.
Yeah, but
and
it's
on the podcast. A little
bit,
yeah.
That one's geared a little bit more towards business work, but I will eventually get around to making one that's more scenic.
Okay, cool. And the Troubles podcast, how many seasons you done now?
How many years? I'm in the middle of season 4 now. Season 4.
Okay.
So 15 episodes a season.
Wow, that's a lot.
I was like, Yeah, people are like, when are you gonna finish? You're gonna run out of stuff. But like I've had some of the most insane conversations and fascinating people that I've met this season that will so I've at least another season in the bag. I'm working on another really interesting project about an undercover operation in the UK. So that is all kind of loosely related to a murder of a solicitor in Northern Ireland, and then this phenomenal operation that was launched in the UK called Operation George. So I'm kind of working on like a standalone season about that, basically.
What was
So
that
it's
solicitor's name? Was he the one that was representing the IRA and he was killed in front of his family?
that's not Pat Finucane,
No.
no.
Pat Finucane,
This was Rosemary Nelson.
yeah.
She was executed by an LVF bomb. So the LVF were a much smaller loyalist paramilitary group. So yeah, well, I can explain that if you want. It's a very interesting story. Or are we on time?
I don't care. Drive on. People keep, every time I do a podcast, people are like, you need to do a longer podcast. I'd be like, man, I run out of steam. But go ahead. You're doing most of the talking.
I got as much. I'm playing football in a couple of hours, but I got a bit of time. So, well, basically, so this was 2001. She was kind of perceived as a solicitor who represented primarily nationalists or Republicans, I guess. So that put a target on her back. Also, that word collusion comes into play a little bit because it was believed that the RUC really didn't like her. So one day she gets into her car and it blows up and she's killed. And they're like, "What happened?" So they kind of reckon they reckon it was the LVF. They have a person they think it was. They think it was this guy by the name of Jimmy Fulton. But they didn't have much else. They also couldn't really. They were like, "Look, the RUC have a bad the reputation here is a bit complicated because of this collusion thing. So we need someone outside to look into this to see if we can figure out how to get her." Or sorry, how to find out who was the person who planted the bomb. So the eyes are on Jimmy. Jimmy ends up over in the USA, maybe hiding out. And then there was an instance where he's found in a house with a bunch of ammunition and like an RPG and everything. And they're like, "What? Like, why are you here?" So instead of facing any charges, he's sent back to Northern Ireland. And then out of the blue, Jimmy gets a call from his friend, Muriel Gibson, who says, "Jimmy, I met a woman over here. She's very interesting. Her husband is kind of part of a group that are looking for a driver. Do you want to just get out of Northern Ireland and get a fresh start?" So Jimmy was like, "Yeah, I think I need this." So he went over to the south of England, and he became a member of like the firm, which is kind of a loose word for like this gang in a way. So he was the driver for Neil. Neil was the boss of the gang. And then for 2 years, Jimmy would drive Neil around, bring him to, they'd do jobs, they had an art heist, they'd steal cigarettes and they'd steal all this sort of stuff. And then at the end of 2 years, bang, the police descend upon Jimmy, they arrest him, they fly him back to Northern Ireland, and he was like, "You've got no, why are you arresting me? I've just been doing nothing." And they're like, "Jimmy, every single person you've talked to for the past 2 years is a police officer. All of your friends, all of the every heist, every gang member you met was one of the most intricate, massive undercover operations. And it was the mousetrap was set, and they just needed him to walk into it. And he did. So yeah, I don't really want to give away the outcome, but they didn't get him for killing Rosemary Nelson, but he won't be coming out of prison anytime soon.
Yeah,
That's the way it
there's some
went.
fascinating stories. So I'll keep listening, and the Troubles podcast, go back to the start and just start listening one at a time, and you'll be hooked. A lot of people have done it, have started listening after I recommended to come back, and they're like, oh my God, it's freaking fascinating. It's a very misunderstood kind of story. Because, like we said earlier, it's so complex. I appreciate you being on the podcast. That was awesome. I'd like to follow up again, maybe in a couple of months, and do another one because I know people are going to want
Yeah,
it.
I feel like we could talk for another 2 hours. In
Oh,
the after
easy,
talking, there was just more
easy,
like,
yeah,
oh yeah, the
easy,
early days of republicanism in the Republic, like some of
yeah,
the bombing, the people who went to prison in England for doing nothing just because they felt a
yeah,
real
the
sense of
Guildford
anger.
Four, and
Guildford Four, the Maguire Seven,
Yeah,
Loch Awe ambush, shoot to kill, and everything. Like it's.
there was so much. There really was. The tie-in with the Irish Army and the
I don't know
way.
anything about you.
I
Very
know,
intriguing.
we'll talk about that.